Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
You file a trade complaint, I file a trade complaint. Hey, everybody's doing it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, July 16th. Good to have you with us. And we are going to start where the news is today. Overseas. No, not at the meeting in Helsinki, but with our global trade policies. Because right now, the U.S. is basically in a trade dispute with everybody. Today, it announced World Trade Organization challenges against the EU, Canada, Turkey, and Mexico, and China. And China filed a WTO complaint of its own. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson covers trade and joins me now. Hi, Tracy.
Hey, Lizzie.
All right, let's go region by region, starting with Europe. Over the weekend, the president called the EU, one of our biggest allies and trading partners, a foe. What gives?
Right. The president said the U.S. has a lot of foes, and the first one he mentioned was the EU for, quote, what they do to us in trade. So this is just another example of how everything for President Trump comes back to trade, and he's willing to upend or revisit traditional alliances to correct what he perceives as trade imbalances. Second point, the use of the term foe to describe the EU is even more striking when you consider that at a press conference this morning after the president's meeting with Vladimir Putin, Trump referred to Putin and Russia as a, quote, good competitor. And he even clarified that he views the term competitor as a compliment. So how could this language impact our relationship with the EU? Donald Tusk, president of the European Council, he seemed determined to shake it off, at least publicly, tweeting that America and the EU are best friends and whoever says we are foes is spreading fake news. Even after President Trump made negative comments about UK Prime Minister Theresa May in the British press, she still expressed a willingness to pursue a US-UK trade deal.
What is the likelihood of that actually happening? There are a lot of headwinds there.
Yeah, look, both countries say they're interested, but even with that mutual interest, there's a long road to go. The UK first has to figure out its relationship with the EU after Brexit. Only then can it look to other deals. And on top of that, these agreements, they take ages. They take years to hash out.
Aside from the UK, other countries seem more interested in doing deals with one another. You mentioned how long this stuff takes. We've pulled out of a lot of multilateral deals. Does that kind of leave the US behind?
It's definitely a concern. So right now, the U.S. strategy seems more about using tariffs to try and pressure trading partners to give us better or more access to their markets. The thing is, those tariffs and, for example, the Trump administration's tough stance on NAFTA renegotiations, they might not be the best way to convince other countries to negotiate new deals with us. House Speaker Paul Ryan brought up the lack of new deals last week when he noted that the U.S. left the TPP and the remaining 11 countries move forward with the deal, that the EU is close to a deal with Japan, and it's also entered into talks with Australia and New Zealand. The list goes on. And the suggestion here is that the U.S. may be left behind if it doesn't get some of its own deals going, that our products would have a harder time competing against products from other countries.
I mentioned the WTO and China earlier. Basically, everyone seems to be upset over tariffs and counter-tariffs. There are all these different complaints. Do challenges at the WTO have any teeth?
Yeah, I put that question actually to Ishwar Prasad. He's a trade policy professor at Cornell. So on the one hand, this is what members of the WTO are supposed to do when they have a trade dispute with one another, bring a complaint. But Prasad says there's also this certain irony to the U.S. bringing all these challenges.
The U.S. seems to want to use the WTO selectively, not playing by the spirit of the WTO rules when it suits the U.S., and then using the WTO rules in order to push back against retaliatory tariffs imposed by its allies.
And he says, given how long disputes take at the WTO, any resolutions here, they're much more likely to come from bilateral talks between the countries involved, not the WTO.
Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson, thank you.
Thanks.
On Wall Street today, kind of a mixed bag as investors waited for earnings. Details when we do the numbers. Today was Amazon's fourth annual Prime Day, a 36-hour window of deep discounts to rack up sales and lure new Prime subscribers. Though that meant a little glitchy website for some users who were directed to an error message with pictures of dogs. Prime Day has become something of a summer Black Friday, with stores like Walmart, Target, and Macy's launching their own sales to compete. And that's going to mean a lot of packages will be on the move. Marketplace's Justin Ho took a look at whether the shipping industry will be able to, yes, deliver.
There's a time-honored reason Amazon picks summer for Prime Day, says Dale Rogers. He's a professor of logistics at Arizona State University.
When I was young, they used to have Christmas in July sales, and it was a way to stimulate demand at a slow time.
And now that so much shopping is done online, summer can be a slow time for shipping companies, too. So Prime Day, which is expected to top $2 billion in sales, not to mention those from competitors.
It's welcome news to all of the shipping companies and their shareholders.
Rob Martinez is CEO of Shipware. He says Amazon and other big outlets have gotten pretty good at working with shipping companies to predict demand. Whether all those companies can handle the summer rush is a different story.
So while FedEx and UPS have resources and engineers to plan and collaborate with customers, the United States Postal Service, generally speaking, does not.
He says the Postal Service mainly gets involved at what's known as the last mile, delivering all those orders from Amazon and others to customers. Prime Day could put the service to the test.
They can't flex as well as UPS and FedEx can.
But summer comes with wiggle room, says Satish Jindal of SGA Consulting Group.
The weather is more favorable in July than in November, December. The days are longer.
One thing that isn't more favorable, the cost of fuel. Diesel's gone up 45% since last summer. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
A government-funded tool that doctors use to figure out the best way to treat patients is going away. It's called the National Guideline Clearinghouse, and budget cuts at the Department of Health and Human Services mean, as of tomorrow, it's gone. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has our story.
Doctors know a lot, but they don't know everything. Harvard Medical School's Dr. Bapu Jena says, for example, it took 20 years for most physicians to get around to prescribing beta blockers for heart disease.
And when you've got a medication that's available and it takes 20 years for doctors to actually use it properly, that tells you something about how difficult it is for information to disseminate into practice.
The National Guideline Clearinghouse, or NGC, has also helped insurance companies and large hospitals develop their own protocols. By putting the variety of guidelines and best practices in one easy-to-use spot, Lisa Simpson with Academy Health says healthcare providers could have confidence in the standards they were using.
And that's what this Guideline Clearinghouse gives everybody. It's that knowledge that there's a place where you can go and find what you need to make choices about the care of individual patients.
Several efforts are underway to salvage the data on the clearinghouse site. One of them has been spearheaded by Fred Trotter with CareSet Systems. He says he's been working since Friday to copy everything before the government site goes down.
You know that the library is going to get bulldozed. You want to absolutely make sure that all of the rare books and the critical books and the books that aren't housed anywhere else are not in the library when it gets bulldozed.
Preserving the existing data might be helpful, but medical guidelines change all the time. In an email, the government agency that runs the NGC says it is exploring options to preserve the guidelines even as its website goes dark. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Retail sales jumped in June, according to data out this morning. Restaurants in particular saw a 1.5% gain, meaning Americans are eating out more. And that's where we're going to focus now. Because if you've eaten at a chain restaurant lately, there might have been a little electronic tablet on your table where you can order, pay, or rate your dining experience. It's called a Ziosk, and they can be found in 4,500 restaurants around the country. And it turns out Ziosk surveys have consequences, especially for servers, because those ratings from customers can generate scores for waitstaff. Caroline O'Donovan wrote about this for BuzzFeed. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What did you find when you talked to different servers about how their scores were used and what happened, you know, with all that data?
What I heard from a number of servers, especially at certain brands of restaurants, was that low Ziosk scores were used to determine what shifts and what kinds of schedules different servers would get. So if you had a lower Ziosk score because someone was unhappy with how their meal was cooked, you might come into a restaurant and find that you had fewer shifts than you normally have in a week, which obviously means, you know, you're not going to be making the same amount of money that you usually make. At another restaurant, you might find that instead of your normal four table section, you have two tables instead. So you're not going to make as much money that evening as you would. Other places, you know, there might be rewards for people with especially high scores, things like that.
From a customer standpoint, did you get any sense that customers actually knew that when they were evaluating their server or even whether the food was cooked to the temperature they wanted, that they knew how this data was going to be used?
No, and I think that's one of the things that was most frustrating for the servers that I spoke with, because if the customers had an experience at the restaurant that's frustrating to them and they want to take the survey, they're probably going to find a way to reflect that in the score that they give. For example, I spoke to one woman who worked at a Chili's who said that she consistently got lower scores on the cleanliness question because the plumbing in the bathroom of the restaurant where she worked was broken. But, you know, she's not a plumber. She's a waitress. So there's very little right. She could do to control that. But customers obviously don't have any way of knowing that unless the server explains that to them. And some people I spoke to, you know, felt uncomfortable doing that. One woman said, I'm already a server for a living. I serve people all day long. I don't really want to have to beg for a rating on top of that.
You know, in one sense, the idea of being able to rate someone, give feedback, do it in a real-time way makes a lot of sense. What did the companies say to you when you brought up these issues with how the scores are used?
Well, unfortunately, most of the restaurant brands declined to talk to me for this story. For the most part, when I called individual restaurants, you know, they said you have to speak to our corporate office. And then the corporate office tended to say, we use a franchise system or we have no way of knowing what's happening in individual restaurants, so we can't really comment on that. I did get to interview the CEO of Ziosk, and interestingly, he was sort of surprised to hear that some of the restaurant chains were using the technology this way. He said, I had a restaurant for 18 years. I would have loved to have this technology to get more data about how my customers were feeling, but I never would have used it for disciplinary purposes. I think he said I would always use it as a carrot, not a stick, basically. But his opinion of that information isn't trickling down to the restaurant chains, which are using it in a different way.
With tablets like Ziosk or other, you know, tools to rate so many of our interactions, like you mentioned, is this a sort of helpful future where things can be quantified and optimized, or is it scary?
I think the thing about gathering more and more data all the time is that you have to be smart about how you use it. There are little ways that you can, I think, try to make data gathering of this kind more accurate, but you have to be really careful with how you do it and think through what all of the consequences are going to be. So I think with the Ziosk, like I said, the problem is I think when you're gathering that data and then you have this number and you decide to use it for disciplinary purposes, but you're not really interrogating how accurate that might be, that you run into problems.
Caroline O'Donovan is a senior tech reporter for BuzzFeed. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Coming up,
these are people who really need to be reached as customers, as users, just like anybody else.
Making the internet more inclusive for people with disabilities. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 44 points, a tenth of a percent, to close at 25,064. The NASDAQ lost 20 points, a quarter percent, to finish at 7,805. And the S&P 500 shed 2 points, a tenth of a percent, to end at 2,798. After the bell, Netflix told Wall Street it had missed its own forecast by more than 1 million subscribers in the second quarter. The stock was hammered in after-hours trading, down by about 14%. We talked about the power of Amazon's Prime Day to move products in the slow summer months. Amazon delivered 0.5%. FedEx dropped off 1.5%, while UPS lifted 1.5%. FCC Chair Ajit Pai said today he has serious concerns about Sinclair Broadcast Group's plans to merge with Tribune Media. Sinclair clicked down more than 11%. Tribune Media lost more than 16%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.85%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Not everybody gets a chance to learn about the economy in school. Marketplace helps you continue your education in a way that's smart, accessible, and hopefully even a bit fun. Your donation is not only an investment in your own learning, but also in helping us make more people smart about the economy, and that is good for everyone. To learn how you can help, visit marketplace.org/investors, and thanks.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. And if you're sad the World Cup is over, hey, there's baseball. Major League Baseball's All-Star Game takes place tomorrow. It's the halfway point of the season, and the good news for MLB is that TV ratings are up. The bad news? League-wide attendance is down compared to last season. Marketplace's Andy Uhler went to find out why.
Minute Maid Park in Houston, Texas. It's noon, 95 degrees. Hundreds of people are lined up at the box office for tickets to watch their Astros take on the Oakland A's. Jason Hilbert's here with his 3-year-old son, James. He's a public school teacher who grew up in Houston.
For me, you know, I have 3 months off out of the year, and the rest of the year I'm kind of looking after other people's children. So this is just an opportunity for me to spend time with my family and actually come out to the ballpark.
League-wide, average tickets will set you back about 3% more than it did last year, according to Team Marketing Report, a trade publication. For the cheap seats, that's just over $32 a ticket. Hilbert says that doesn't include all the other stuff he shells out for at the ballpark, like Cokes, hot dogs, maybe a beer. It adds up, so he tries to economize.
I bought these tickets through Groupon, and I think I paid like $13.
Hilbert loves the atmosphere at the stadium, high-fiving strangers after a base hit, singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game in the seventh-inning stretch. Plus, the Astros are on a tear. They won the World Series last year and have one of the best records in baseball so far this year.
Prior to the last 2 years, I haven't seen attendance like this probably in 15 years or so.
According to Major League Baseball, the Astros' gate numbers have gone up more than any of the other 30 teams in the league. It's great news for the Astros, but it's not the norm. Maury Brown tracks attendance for the research and analytics company BizBall. He says attendance league-wide is down about 6.5% from last year. And the actual attendance is probably lower. Brown says the official attendance figures aren't necessarily the exact number of people who turn up. In fact, a game that's deemed a sellout could have hundreds of empty seats.
The numbers that you hear and see in the box score are the tickets that are sold, and therefore those that are bought up by secondary ticket brokers or from season ticket holders that don't go to games if the weather's bad, those people are not accounted for at the games.
The league blames much of this year's drop in attendance on the weather, and it's got a point. In the first 3 weeks of the season, bad weather caused 25 games to be postponed. Rainouts aside, though, Brown says improvements in home viewing are also keeping fans out of the stands.
Television has gotten much better in terms of its form factor, in terms of theater aspect ratio, and the fact that you can augment that with additional statistics or a second window with your computer, it does make it a lot easier to stay at home.
That's exactly what Greg Stovall does most game nights. He's an avid baseball fan, grew up in Arlington, Texas, home of the Texas Rangers. He remembers going to the games with his brother and grandfather, but even when he watches at home, he's still got his rituals.
A lot of times I'll turn the game on and then I'll turn the audio on to listen to the radio broadcast, but watch the game.
Stovall says he still gets to a few Rangers games a year, loves taking his 12-year-old daughter, Anna. He wants his kid to have the same great experience as he had as a child, but, you know, he says it's different now.
Doing it online, doing it through internet, doing it through smart TV, and us being lazy, you know, people take advantage of that. So maybe there's your answer as far as why ticket sales are down.
But maybe this year is just a blip. Major League Baseball says more than 72 million fans have turned out to the ballpark each year for the past 14 straight seasons. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Roughly 20% of Americans have one or more disabilities. And just like the physical one, the digital world isn't always readily accessible. So going to a website, if you're visually impaired, probably involves using a screen reader. And it might sound like this.
Link mentioned on air. Link podcasts. Link heading level 3 sponsor marketplace today. Link become a corporate sponsor.
That was Marketplace's website being read by a screen reader, a tool often used by people who have difficulty seeing a screen.
They'll usually have that running at all times from the moment that they boot up their computer. And the screen reader this entire time is reading everything that's happening for them. It's verbalizing every interface.
That was Mikey Illigan, a web developer and accessibility specialist. I asked him what barriers there are to making tech more accessible.
I think first and foremost is that ensuring keyboard compatibility. So really just your everyday computer keyboard. If all websites and applications were accessible with just keyboard controls, it's actually accounting for a ton of devices. So screen readers, as mentioned, but really all types of input devices that people who, you know, may have some sort of physical disability, you know, they use all sorts of devices that kind of work in a, like a keyboard. And so if things were keyboard compatible, the whole web or really, you know, digital interfaces would be a lot more accessible and friendly.
And when we talk about the physical space, certainly in the U.S., the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, applies. Is there anything, I guess, similar to that governing the internet?
Well, internet's you know, a bit different. I guess, in short, there's really no one legal governing body, even in the U.S., that puts out the standards and determines what is accessible and what isn't, the same way that the ADA does in the kind of a real-life physical space. But there are the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, which are put out by the World Wide Web Consortium. And a lot of laws are kind of matched to the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, or WCAG. So while the guidelines are more or less standards and not law per se, a lot of laws throughout the world actually design their laws to kind of reflect those guidelines.
Tell me the business case for you know, making tech and the internet more accessible?
Sure. I think what usually motivates people to get going is the, I guess, the threat of litigation. So it's cheaper and easier to make sure your experiences are accessible now rather than having to fix it anyway and then encountering some sort of lawsuit and whatever that may cost or entail. People with disabilities are also an untapped market. So depending on where you pull your statistics from, up to or around 20% of people just in this country, in the U.S., have one or more disability. So these are people who really need to be reached as customers, as users, just like anybody else.
Are there examples of tech that was created perhaps for someone with a disability that has evolved and gone mainstream?
Actually, the example that comes to mind is something from the physical world. So not specifically something digital, but I'd like to use OXO.
Yeah, like the scrubber things?
Yeah, so the founder's wife had severe arthritis. So the tools that he created were keeping people with severe arthritis in mind. And so, but we've kind of come to understand them to just be great, usable, well-designed products. And so I think that is a great example of how accessibility benefits everybody.
Wow. Okay, cool. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Cool. Thank you.
You can check out a Marketplace special report on the economics of disability. We've got stories about education, healthcare, and the world of work. Just go to marketplace.org. This final note before we go today, and I guess it's only fitting on Prime Day, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos is now the richest person in modern history, according to Bloomberg News. His net worth broke $150 billion this morning. That's more than Bill Gates, more than Warren Buffett, and more than anyone, according to Bloomberg, since 1982 when Forbes started keeping track. Probably worth checking back after Prime Day is over. And for a little perspective about the gap between the very rich and everyone else, according to the Federal Reserve, the top 1% of U.S. families controlled 38.6% of the country's wealth in 2016. All right, that's it. We got to go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 44 points, a tenth of a percent. The NASDAQ lost 20 points, a quarter of a percent. And the S&P 500 shed 2 points, just a tenth of a percent. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. And I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. Have a good day. We'll see you all tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.